You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Several years ago, I spoke with Dr. Sam Parney, who's one of the directors of the AWARE study, or Awareness During Resuscitation, a study to better understand near-death experiences. The ideas of out-of-body experiences, the tunnel of life, feeling of peace, and other phenomena that resuscitated cardiac arrest patients will sometimes recall. In his new book, he reveals some of the first findings of the AWARE study, but the real news in his book, Erasing Death, is what we're learning about death itself. We often think of death occurring in a moment in time, but now we know it is a process where a patient can be revived not just in a few minutes, but with the proper interventions hours after cardiac arrest and brain function cease. That's hours, and revived with brain function intact. Dr. Sam Parney is one of the world's leading experts on the scientific study of death and the human mind-brain relationship and near-death experiences. He splits time between the United Kingdom and the United States, and he directs the AWARE study. He's a professor of critical care medicine and director of resuscitation research at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He also reveals what science is revealing about near-death experiences themselves and raises the idea that psyche and soul continue, at least through the first hours of death, and raises questions scientifically in a realm generally left to theology and philosophy. The name of the book is Erasing Death, the Science That is Rewriting the Boundaries Between Life and Death. It's published by Harper One. Dr. Sam Parney, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We spoke several years ago when the AWARE study was first getting underway. And we'll talk about AWARE in a little bit. And I've been interested ever since we had that conversation to know what you're finding out. But I have to say, that's not the big news in this book. The big news is the advancement in resuscitation science that with the proper emergency therapies, a person can be clinically dead for hours, not minutes, and can be resuscitated with no ill effects. This seems like an amazing development.
It really is. I think there's a revolution that's been happening in the field of resuscitation science. And the purpose in documenting these in Erasing Death is to make people aware of this, which is that, first of all, we now understand that death is fully reversible. And when I say that, I'm not playing with words. I don't mean people who are near death. I mean people who had literally died, somebody who was turned into a corpse. And the reason for that is that it's only after a person dies that the cells inside the body start to undergo their own process of death. And although most people have always thought that brain cells only have 4 or 5 minutes before they die, what we now understand is that by 4 or 5 minutes, brain cells no longer have any energy or oxygen left. But actually, they go through their own process of death, which can last around 8 hours or more. And therefore, the things that we do after someone's heart has stopped, after they've died, will make the difference between somebody coming back to life and without brain damage, or potentially not coming back, or unfortunately coming back with brain damage. And that's the big story.
Yeah, you mentioned that the cells begin dying after a few minutes. And if you're, say, out on a baseball field and you go into cardiac arrest and you're not given oxygen, you're not given CPR immediately, you're going to have severe brain damage. But there are new techniques that, you liken it to, you think of death more like a stroke, but involving the whole brain. You use this analogy in the idea that, you know, if you get to a stroke victim immediately, you can really recover most of the functions of the affected area of the stroke. But if you don't, the brain cells die and you have real serious impairments. Is that a good analogy?
Yes, it is. You see, because again, most of us have very fixed ideas about what life and death is. And we think that when you die, by definition, you couldn't come back again. And that's really a social or a philosophical idea of death. But the reality is that death is a biological process. And essentially, as far as the brain is concerned, when somebody dies, it's the same processes that occur when someone's having a stroke. Now, this might sound strange, but if you think about it, when someone has a stroke, all that happens is a piece of clot, blood clot, goes into and blocks one of the blood vessels in the brain, and therefore the area of the brain that's supplied by that blood dies. And this process takes many hours, which is why we try to intervene within the first 4 hours and hopefully restore the brain. Well, when somebody dies, all that's happening is that there is no blood getting to the entire brain. And therefore, as far as the brain cells are concerned, they can't tell the difference whether it was a clot or whether someone's heart stopped and therefore they died. But the same biological processes occur, which means that if we intervene in the same way that we try to do with stroke patients, we have a number of hours to potentially bring a whole person back and send them back to their families. And that's really the big advancement in resuscitation.
You describe the process of what brain cells do when they quit receiving oxygen. What is the process and why does it take that long?
Well, for a long time, we had come to understand that within about 4 or 5 minutes, the levels of oxygen that are present in brain cells and supply of energy run out. It can be between 2 to 4 minutes. But you see, what then happens is a process by which the cells die. And cells die through chemical processes. It's simply a chemical event that occurs. And like many things, is regulated by different factors, including temperature. The biggest discovery, therefore, came when we understood that actually the process by which cells die take a lot longer than we'd ever perceived. So to give you some sort of insight about this, 10 years ago, an experiment was done in La Jolla in California, where scientists took biopsies of brain tissue from cadavers. And I mean people who had been dead for 4 hours or more, who had been taken to a mortuary. And what they found, to their astonishment, was that they could actually grow brain cells from those tissues, from the brain that was from a dead person, in the laboratory. And in fact, the longest period that they managed to do this for was in someone who'd been dead for 21 hours. So it gives you some insight that cells take time to become irreversibly and irretrievably damaged after you stop giving them oxygen, in other words, after a person dies. And that's why if we manipulate these, we can change it. And one of the biggest discoveries is that if we cool people down, because cooling reduces the rate by which chemical reactions occur, you can actually prolong the cells for even longer periods of time.
And you tell us a case history of a gentleman named Joe Tirolosi, who suffered a cardiac arrest. He was, I assume, at the very first moments, heart activity had stopped, lung activity had stopped, the eyes were fixed and dilated. And we're talking about continuing attempts to resuscitate him, and we're talking an hour or more. These therapies were applied. He's eventually able to walk out of the hospital and resume life as if nothing happened after these therapies. Tell us a little bit about his story.
It's important to realize that cardiac arrest, the word cardiac arrest, is absolutely synonymous with death. Most people think of cardiac arrest the same as a heart attack. They don't realize that it's death. Because the definition of death is when the heart stops, person stops breathing, and the brain stops functioning, and therefore a person becomes lifeless. And the way we determine that, as you pointed, is that we shine a light on the eyes and the reflexes that are related to the brain don't function anymore. That's how we diagnose someone as being dead. However, 50 years ago, we discovered, so although for centuries and millennia, we never thought it was possible to overcome death, to go beyond the threshold of death. And that's why people have this fixed idea of life and death. We then discovered that actually, if you start doing CPR, you can bring people back, say, for 10 or 20 minutes after someone's died. But now we realize that we can go on for much longer periods of time. So in this case, Joe Tirolosi was somebody who was dead for almost an hour and eventually was brought back to life. And the thing that really preserved his brain and saved him was that the doctors in the hospital cooled him down, and that made sure that eventually he recovered, and therefore he was considered a miracle, because more and more doctors are now seeing people who they used to perceive as having no chance of recovery coming back and having meaningful lives.
And in this case, it involved putting ice packs underneath the armpits, along the neck, along the places where blood flows. It also meant chilled saline in the lines going into him, intravenous lines, and that bought him the time.
That's right. In his case, it was started that way, and then the hospital had a sophisticated machine that would cool him down more effectively. But it was certainly started out with very primitive methods, literally ice packs being put all over his body to cool him down. And what we now know is that actually, although his case was remarkable, there are others who have been resuscitated well after what was ever thought possible. For instance, one of the hospitals in London, where I do research, called me about a year and a half ago to say that they had miraculously saved someone who had been dead for 3.5 hours. And the reason they managed to do that was because they were using these very sophisticated machines that deliver perfect quality chest compressions and can go well above human endurance. So no human can provide 3.5 hours worth of CPR. But with a machine, they were able to do it, and this person was again cold, and therefore, to their astonishment, he walked out of the hospital less than a week later without any brain damage. And then I saw another case which I find most astonishing, published from a Japanese hospital, where a young woman who was 30 years old, normally fit and healthy, was essentially found dead in a forest at 8:30 in the morning, and she'd taken some pills the night before, and she'd been dead for at least 5 hours, possibly longer. And we know that because her body temperature had dropped incredibly low, down to 68 degrees Fahrenheit. And to cut a long story short, she was found, the ambulance crews took her to the hospital, and the hospital connected her up to a special machine which is used commonly in Japan, where they take the blood out, provided oxygen from the outside, and then pump it around the body. And then they took 6 hours to gradually warm her up, and then eventually by about 2:30 in the afternoon, her heart restarted, and 3 weeks later, she walked out of the hospital.
Wow.
If you think about it, what this means for our definitions of life and death is that if the Titanic had sunk in 2012 instead of 1912, almost everyone who died in the water, you probably remember the scenes from the movie when the ship arrived, they found all these dead bodies in the water. Almost all of those people would have been potentially revived using the means and the technology that was available in 2012 as opposed to 1912.
Wow, that's amazing. The other part of this book deals with what we've learned about resuscitation techniques. You write that, you know, since the 1970s, the standard procedures have been ventilation, chest compression, electricity, you know, like a defibrillation, and vasopressor drugs. And while that improved the percentage somewhat, as that became standard, doctors began noticing drawbacks. And the fact that you use the analogy of space travel to describe the drawbacks in bringing people back from cardiac arrest, and you said, you know, we can get them into space, it's getting them back that is the problem. There are all these problems developed. And it's very interesting because you, in fact, talk about zip code lottery in these new techniques that you've been describing, and only about half the hospitals in the U.S. are using some of these techniques.
You're absolutely right. You see, if you think about it conceptually, if you'd mentioned to somebody 100 years ago that one day we'd go to the moon and come back, they'd think you were completely crazy. Because throughout history, you know, humankind had always gazed in the stars and wondered what they were about. They'd always looked at the moon, you know, poems were written about the moon, but they never thought it possible to one day step foot on the moon. Yet, within about 60 years, human beings had landed onto the moon. And what we find with death is very similar. Conceptually, we have never thought it possible to overcome death. That's why we have this very fixed idea. And today, when you tell people that we can reverse death, it astonishes them. But the reality is that by serendipity, this wasn't planned in a sense, but by serendipity, we discovered a way to overcome death and bring people back about 50 years ago. But the big discovery was that even though people can do CPR, and we can restart the heart and bring someone back to life in the short term, long term, most of those people even died again and again and again within the subsequent hours to days, such that actually the overall survival from people who've had CPR attempted on them remained incredibly low and hadn't really changed for about 50 years, which was astonishing when you think of all the advancements in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, to give you ideas, you're looking about, if it happened in hospitals, you're looking about a 15 to 20% survival. And if it happened in the community, some places 5%, some places 0% survival, and occasional areas of excellence where they had about 15% survival. Now, what we discovered in the last 10 years, which is what's the real game changer, is that actually the reason why these people were dying again and again was the complications that were occurring after we attempted CPR was what was causing them to die. So to give an analogy, it was like we went to the moon, but we didn't realize that coming back into the atmosphere is so hazardous, it's so dangerous, and that people will burn just in the reentry. And what's happening with the brain after someone's had CPR is that it goes through a very unnatural state where it starts to burn up, in effect, as a consequence, as does the heart, as do all the other organs, and that's why people ended up dying. And so what's really making the difference is where people try to implement measures to prevent that burning process from going on, and that's what's allowing places to improve really high levels of survival. All these people who I mentioned to you, and cooling is one of them, had received some element of care that focused on this. However, the unfortunate thing is that the standard of care in the United States and elsewhere is generally unregulated, and therefore individuals within the same hospital practice things differently, and therefore outcomes can be very different for people, and that's what we need to change.
Yeah, you in fact mentioned that there is no standard of care regarding these new techniques. In fact, you tell a story of two soccer players that suffered cardiac arrest in 2012, during a game, Fabrice Muamba in England and then Pier Mario Morosini in Italy. These two players had vastly different fates, and it went directly to the level of care they received from the field all the way to the hospital.
I have to point out, there are standards of care. I have to clarify this. There are standards. There's an international organization composed of the world's leading experts in resuscitation who meet every 5 years, and they come up with guidelines that inform the medical community on what should happen. The problem, though, is that these guidelines are not implemented, and most of the time, physicians and nurses don't know about them in detail. They know it in very, very faint outline. And therefore, people are just essentially continuing with the way they used to practice resuscitation 30 years ago. What I mentioned was that there's no external regulation. There's no, like, an equivalent of an FAA. There's no body that would go to hospitals and ensure that the highest standards of care are being delivered. And that's where we're failing. So when you take this example that, you know, and this happens all the time, people have cardiac arrests, and sometimes it happens to very young people. And in this case, two professional soccer players, one in England, as you mentioned, and one in Italy, had a cardiac arrest within 4 weeks of each other. And this young man, Fabrice Muamba, who used to play for Bolton, a team in England, had a cardiac arrest, full view of live cameras, died, was out for 90-plus minutes. The paramedics continued to try to restart his heart. Importantly, there was a cardiologist who happened to be a spectator watching the game, and he ran to the field, and he made sure that the ambulance crew don't take him to the local hospital, but take him to his own hospital, which was a major medical center, where they had cooling therapies. And I assume that's because he knew what I know, which is that you don't always get this wherever you go. Mm-hmm. And he went to the hospital where he got cooled, and within 4 weeks he left, and he was not brain damaged. And in fact, he could have restarted playing again. And then another young man playing soccer, as I said, same time in Italy, had a cardiac arrest. He didn't get timely CPR, and eventually they couldn't restart his heart. But I think if we had standards, probably many more, if not all of these people, could be brought back to life again. And that's one of the things that we struggle with right now.
You mentioned the fact that resuscitation science is sort of an orphan. You have cardiologists who are concerned with the heart. You have pulmonologists who are concerned with the circulation. You have neuroscientists concerned with the brain. But there's not a resuscitation involves all three of those systems, right?
In order to bring someone back to life safely without brain damage, you have to pay attention to many different areas which cut across different fields. But unfortunately, the problem is because, as I mentioned, cardiac arrest, even though there's the word cardiac in it, it's not about a heart attack. It really is about death. And therefore, people can die in hospitals under the care of many different types of doctors. And since there is no standard being enforced, each doctor within their own area will focus on certain things that's their area of expertise, while possibly neglecting or not being aware of other things that need to also be done. And that's why often you may find in the same institution, a patient will get different care depending on which bed they end up at for that reason. So I think we need to make sure that there is external regulation put upon this, because what most people don't realize, again, is that this is the only condition that will, by definition, affect every single one of us. I will definitely have a cardiac arrest in my lifetime, and unfortunately so will you, and so will every single person listening to this program, because it's not a heart attack, it's that they die. And most of us aren't going to die at the age of 95 through old age. Maybe 90-plus percent of us are going to die prematurely due to some illness or to an accident. And whether we like it or not, someone's going to attempt resuscitation on us. But if they don't enforce all the standards, our chance of coming back alive and hopefully without brain damage is completely down to pot luck. It's completely down to chance. And that's not a chance that I would like to take, because I don't want to end up, and I'm sure neither does anybody else, in a vegetative state like Terry Schiavo did. And that's why, unless we have, you know, central enforcement of the highest standards of care that are published, that are out there, then all of us are at risk. And often they're young kids. They're people playing sports, playing basketball, playing soccer, where this happens to.
My guest today is Dr. Sam Parnia. He splits time between the UK and the US. In the US, he's a professor of critical care medicine and the director of resuscitation research at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He's the author of Erasing Death, the Science That Is Rewriting the Boundaries Between Life and Death. It's published by HarperOne. In the second half of the book, this has been getting a lot of attention as well, you deal with what happens to us when we do experience death experience, cardiac arrest, clinical death. And you're following on the work of Raymond Moody, who first chronicled this back in 1975, the idea of the bright light, the feeling of peace, the family members. And you've been investigating this, and what you've come up with says we need a new scientific theory of the mind based on what you found.
I'd like to actually point something interesting out in your question. You see, I don't know if you noticed, but you kind of struggled to call this death. You called it clinical death, you called it, and this is interesting because people find it hard to understand and accept that people have really died. And that's why we have this term that people use, like, oh, well, they were clinically dead. I'm not sure what it means, clinically dead. People say, you know, no, they died. And that's the point, you know. So I just wanted to clarify. It was interesting, and I always get this because I find that people just cannot, in their mind, they understand what we say, but in their heart, they cannot accept it, and they come out with different words.
And you write the fact that these experiences I'm talking about are referred to as near-death experiences, and you say they should be actual death experiences.
That's absolutely right, because you see, what's happened is now that we have, so I'm an intensive care physician. My goal is to save people's lives, and I don't want people to get brain damage, and that's what drives me to do the work that I do. However, we also never forget, and this is the flip side, we never forget that there's a human being in there who may have been dead for tens of minutes or even over an hour of time that we're trying to bring back. And what we've now discovered is that, in the same way by analogy to space science, that people have now gone beyond the threshold of death, sometimes for quite long periods of time, and we're able to bring them back. And they're able to give us, in essence, what are witnessed accounts of what it's like to go beyond the threshold of death. And what we found is that these experiences are very universal, they're consistent. People describe this incredible sense of peace. They describe a sensation of seeing a bright, warm, welcoming light. They describe a sensation of a tunnel going to a beautiful place. They often describe a sensation of having an instantaneous review of their entire life, and sometimes even going through a process where they judge their own actions. It's an educational process for them that's full of love and compassion. And at times, they also even describe watching doctors and nurses working on them, and they believe that they have separated out from their body, and they're, in essence, their mind, consciousness, the psyche or the soul was watching events that were going on. As you pointed out, this was first pointed out by Raymond Moody, in 1975, and I think the reason for that was because it was only after we managed to discover CPR and discover a way to bring people back to life, at least early after they had died, that we had many more of these accounts that came through. And by now, you know, around 2013, there are, of course, millions and millions of these accounts all over the world. And therefore, it's our job in science to also investigate these. And the evidence that we found so far suggests that that entity that makes us who we are, whether you call it the mind, consciousness, psyche, or the soul, does not become annihilated when somebody dies. It continues to exist, and it goes into a hibernation type of mode where we can't see it, but it does exist. And that's also supported by the fact that many people can come back and tell us exactly what we were doing, when in fact they had gone through death, and more importantly, because they'd gone through death, their brain had stopped functioning. So even though the cells have not become annihilated, but the cells don't work, the brain doesn't function, yet consciousness appears to continue to function, at least for the first few hours after a person has died.
Now, the big debate over the last few years has been, are these experiences real? I say, you know, how do we know what real is? But what are they real, or is it just the body's way of, you know, sort of switching off the lights? The dying brain theory, you address this in the book. What is your opinion on that?
This near-death experience was described by Raymond Moody, or after that, I should say, a lot of scientists tried to explain it, and they tried to explain it in the way that they understood best themselves. And this led to the concept of the dying brain theory, that basically, in essence, these experiences are most likely some kind of hallucination brought about by a change in some chemical in the brain, whether it be oxygen or carbon dioxide or some other drugs. However, that really is an outdated view of this, which I think is related to the 20th century. The 21st century understanding of this is that actually there is no plausible mechanism from a chemical perspective to be able to account for why these experiences occur. And in particular, it's important to understand the people that we study are people who've objectively died, and that's why I call them actual death experiences. And when someone's objectively died, there is no brain function. So therefore, it's impossible to even hallucinate. And what we've come to understand is that these experiences are real in the sense that they happen. We don't think that they're a hallucination. And what we have to accept is that they're real for the people who've had them. So if I haven't had an experience like that, maybe I don't understand it and I don't necessarily believe it, and that may be okay. But it doesn't mean that it's not real. It's real for the people who've had them. These experiences of the other side, this vision of the afterlife, should we call it, is real for the people who've had them. And our job in science, I think, is to remain neutral and study these phenomena objectively.
Now, we only have a couple minutes left, but at the beginning of our conversation, I mentioned the AWARE study, which is looking at the idea of out-of-body experiences, because a very common, well, frequently in these actual death experiences, people will say they're looking down upon their body. You've been trying to measure that. What have you found so far?
The only aspect of people's experiences that we can potentially test scientifically, at least for its validity, is when they have this so-called out-of-body experience where they describe watching doctors and nurses working on them. And we've had many, many people, including physicians, who tell us that their patients have told them incredible details that could not have been known about any other way about what was going on. In order to test this, we set up a study where we installed pictures that were placed in prominent positions in areas where resuscitation takes place that were only visible from the ceiling. But what we found so far with this, which I've outlined in Erasing Death, is that, and this study is going to be continuing, we're going to modify it, is that the occurrence of out-of-body experiences is far less frequent than we had realized. It's about less than 1%. And the people who have them have this perception of seeing things from any part of the room. So therefore, putting a single image in one place may not be sufficient because their perception could be that they're looking from elsewhere. One of the most interesting cases that we had, though, which again adds weight to the fact that we need to study this, was a gentleman who had an out-of-body experience, and he recalled in specific detail events that took place over a 5-minute period in which his brain could not have been functioning and he was going through death. And specifically, he remembers machines in the room who were the automated that have, you know, these robotic machines that have conversations that they describe. And he could describe those in very specific details, which were documented by the nursing and medical staff also in his chart. And so what we've sort of come to understand is that the occurrence of these experiences is somewhat of a paradox, because people seem to have consciousness when their brain doesn't function and they've gone through death. But in order to study them and test them, we need to expand the AWARE study, which is what we're in the process of doing now.
One last question. Earlier, one of the things you write about these death experiences is that we might need a new scientific theory of the mind, because people are processing information at a time when their brain is not cognitive. It's flatlined. Has there been resistance to this idea from the medical establishment at this point?
That's an interesting question, you see, because the question of what is the self, what is our mind, what is consciousness, has intrigued humankind for millennia. I mean, if you look back at the Greek philosophers, they all debated this, and they were interested in what is it that makes us into who we are. And while many, including Plato, argued that that entity of the self, the psyche, that was later translated into the word soul, is a separate entity to the body, there were others like Aristotle who largely believed that the soul is nothing more than the product of bodily processes. And when you look in science today, you know, all these years later, these broad views are still in existence. There are some scientists who broadly believe that somehow the soul, that thing that makes us who we are, is produced from the brain. And there are others who believe the brain is acting as an intermediary that manifests the mind, manifests the psyche or the soul, but isn't the producer. What's important with our work is that this is the only time where we know that you can potentially separate the mind from the brain, because the brain shuts down completely. And the fact that there are all these reports now of people whose consciousness appears to have continued when there was no brain function seems to support the idea that the human mind, the psyche, or the soul is a separate entity to the brain, and that Plato may have been correct as opposed to Aristotle. But of course, this work needs to continue. But if that is proven beyond doubt, then that means that we have to have a new science that deals with the psyche or the soul, and that will be something intriguing, of course.
The name of the book is Erasing Death. Dr. Parnia, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Sam Parnia is the author of Erasing Death, The Science That is Rewriting the Boundaries Between Life and Death. It's published by Harper One. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.